What's up, y'all? Welcome to today's podcast. Today we have Mohammed Shahata with us, one of my homies right here. He went to Iowa State University, studied architecture, and is currently working as an architect out in Wisconsin. And he's going to be giving us a breakdown of, you know, what a career in architecture entails, as well as telling us a little bit about himself and giving us some game on how to get into architecture and what advice he might have. What's up, man? How you been?
Good, man. How you doing? It's been a while.
Yeah, for real. How's everything going? How's life in Wisconsin?
Everything is good. Wisconsin is really good. I've been working from home for a while now, so I've been getting used to the secluded life. But aside from that, everything's good.
I feel you. That's what's up. Thanks for taking the time to hop on the podcast. You know, I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Every all of the podcasts I've been seeing are very uplifting, and it's an incredibly good endeavor. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I know it's helping a lot of people, so I just want to partake.
I really appreciate it, man. And I'm gonna give some, I know you know about it, but I'm gonna give some context real quick for some of those that might be watching for the first time. So whole purpose of the podcast, you know, one of the biggest issues we see in low-income communities today is, you know, when we look for examples of success within our communities, it's typically limited to, you know, athletics, artists, or, you know, your local street pharmacist. So it's very rare to see folks in different disciplines such as, you know, architecture, or whether it's engineering or real estate, or just people that own equity in a sense, because most of the time, you know, the goal is to leave the hood. And it's not that folks don't want to give back. It's just they're not in that community anymore due to the fact that, you know, they're in a higher income bracket or living in a different community now. So the whole purpose of the podcast is kind of be that example and show folks, examples of those different disciplines, as well as break down how to get into those disciplines, as well as what challenges can be expected through that process and how to overcome them. So real quick to start out, Mohammed, could you give us a quick rundown of, you know, who you are for those that don't know? I know myself, I know you really well, but for those that don't know, can you describe to them who you are, where you're from?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Mohammed Shahata. I was born and raised in Cedar Falls, Iowa. I'm originally Egyptian. I was made in Egypt and I was born in America, if you catch my drift. And I grew up in a predominantly white town, as, you know, a minority. You could probably count the number of minorities on your fingers, like, you know, at the high school that I went to. So I grew up, you know, in a place where I was always looked at, you know, people, whatever I did, that's what Egyptian people do. Whatever I did, that's what Muslim people do. So I always lived my life kind of with a microscope, in a way that people were always looking at what I did. And so I was very cognizant in the way that I acted and the things that I said and did and participated in, and that really shaped me to be who I am today. And yeah.
For sure. One thing I also like to do is also kind of dive a little bit deeper into, you know, folks' upbringing. You kind of went into that a little bit. Out of curiosity, you know, were there any things that you were kind of involved in at an early age that you might feel like kind of helped you through development, or maybe kind of steered you towards architecture? Or what was the first like career you kind of maybe thought about going into as a kid?
Absolutely. Yeah. So growing up, I always felt like I was different from everybody else. And so I always had kind of this passion to prove myself. And because of that, I was always, you know, I was always part of, you know, more groups than everybody else. And I was always like participating and speaking up. I always tried to stand up for the little guy, the people that never were able to stand up for themselves. And so in high school, I really took an engagement to the social activism part of high school. And I formed a group called Harmony. And Harmony pretty much was about all of the students that weren't the same, and pretty much like not the typical white person in Iowa. And we went around teaching teachers how to teach children that aren't the same and how to treat them correctly within the classroom. So, you know, we had the LGBTQ community, we had Muslims, we had you know, people of all different categories to try to, you know, kind of teach people how to treat everyone normally, which is really weird because like in 2020, that makes sense that, you know, everyone should be treated the same. But growing up, that was not the same. I mean, we grew up in 2001 and we went through the things that happened then. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends during that time because, you know, parents would tell their kids to not hang out with me and I didn't understand why. And my father, you know, being a leader in the Islamic community, explained to me very early in my life that like people are treating you differently because of this, that, and the other. And that really gave me a sense of who I am because I felt like I was an American growing up my entire life, but I'm also an Egyptian Muslim and I look different. And those are the things that kind of shaped me to be this kind of like activist person that I am now. And I'm very much the kind of person that will, you know, reach out to help the person that's being bullied, and speak out for people that don't have a voice. And those are the things that kind of like shape me to be exactly who I am now.
That's amazing, man.
Absolutely.
How long were you doing that for? Or when did you first start that?
My entire life. I remember the first time I was in second grade, we had Ramadan, which is a month that Muslims fast, which means we don't eat from sunup to sundown. And I brought in candy for all of the class and we handed out the candy and me and my father explained to them what, you know, what Ramadan was and, you know, how Muslims celebrate. Because there were, during that time, there were all these people that were explaining like, you know, Kwanzaa and, you know, Yom Kippur for Jewish people and everything, but nobody brought up Islam. And so I felt the need to do that because I was that one Muslim friend that everyone has. You know how everyone has that one black friend? I was that one Muslim friend. And so I felt the need to explain that. And so that was kind of like part of my characteristics growing up my entire life.
For sure. And then I'm curious with the group you just mentioned, Harmi, when did you start that? Was that
That would have been ninth or 10th grade of my senior year. And I started that with the idea of, you know, giving people a platform to speak on, for teachers mostly, but then it brought into students as well. So we started giving like school-wide, you know, lectures and stuff. And I was very happy to hear that after I graduated, that group actually continued and it became a citywide thing. So it wasn't only the high school that I went to, Cedar Falls High. It was the entire city. They got kids from everywhere and they made a big group. So it's very nice to see that something that you started kind of progressed even after you were gone.
That's amazing, man. I'm curious too, what kind of also steered you towards architecture? Because with, you know, with your experiences, you know, you'd think maybe you'd be trying to go for like public office or something of that nature, since you're something that's always been extremely active in the community.
Yeah. So to be honest, I was raised in a typical, you know, foreign household. So you're either bred to be an engineer or a doctor, pretty much. That's what success means to Middle Easterns or foreigners in general. And so I grew up thinking that I was going to be a mechanical engineer my whole life. When I was in college, the whole time, I knew that I was going to go to Iowa State University, which is world renowned for its engineering. And my senior year of high school, one of my electives, I took an architecture class, and I took that class not knowing really what architecture was, just out of curiosity. And during that time, our main goal was to design like a store, like Walmart or something like that. And so they taught us about, you know, how people act within a group and like how to arrange things so that people will buy more, you know, just like all of these things that will cause people to make different moves. And I never really thought about that until I took that class. In hindsight, that is not what architecture is solely about, but that's what got me interested. And my father was he wasn't angry, but he was disappointed when I chose architecture over mechanical engineering, because mechanical engineering is a very safe job, no matter when you graduate or what you graduate in mechanical engineering, you can always get a job. But during the time that I graduated, which was 2011, which was a couple of years after 2008, you know, the economy crashed and everything, architecture was one of the most unemployed professions in the country. And so, you know, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I'm curious as to, you know, where do you think that kind of like cultural norm kind of stems from? Like, because, you know, whether it's Egyptian or Sudanese households, or, you know, you're looking at Nigerian households, it's a lot of immigrant communities typically look to, you know, you're either going into law, engineering, or medicine, and it's just limited to those three things.
Yeah, I mean, the reason, it's twofold. So the first one is prestige. Like, they're, for some reason, you know, foreigners hold certain professions in high prestige. Mm-hmm. And one of them is engineers, and the other are doctors, pretty much. And the second reason is because of income. You know, doctors, everybody knows doctors make the most money, you know. So if you're a doctor, you're, like, killing it, right?
Yeah.
And engineers are very close second. And they make an impact on the community, and so people hold them in very high regards. So I think that's the reason why people like foreigners and Arabs hold those in very high, you know, regard. So when I chose architecture, you know, my father was never really one to tell me no. But you can see the look on his face, like it was like kind of like disappointed, because, you know, when I told him I wanted to go into architecture, the next thing he showed me were like the statistics of how much architects make and, like, you know, the unemployment rate and blah, blah, blah. But I was more interested in doing something that I loved than making a lot of money, you know.
For sure. And then when was the first time you ever like heard about architecture?
To be completely honest, it was that class. It was that high school class that I took. And, you know, it's also one of the reasons that I've been so passionate about architecture afterward, is because I've realized what architecture is and the capability of architecture on making an impact in the community. And I've realized that very many Black and minority people don't know what architecture is, and they don't become architects. Like, if you look at the statistics, 1% of all architects in America are Black or minority.
Really, only 1%?
Yes. And there's even a less percent of Black and minority architects that are in positions of management, which is a whole other story, because, like, you know, when you're in a position of management, then you can make moves, then you can actually, like, make an impact. But architecture is an old white man profession by nature.
For sure. And can you break down, so what does a career in architecture entail? And, like, let's say you did go into it, what are the different, like, career trajectories that you can kind of have as an architect?
Yeah, that's a very deep question. So first of all, you know, architecture by nature is probably one of the last generalist majors there are. And which means, yeah, so most majors are specialized, mm-hmm. which means you learn a lot about a specific topic. right? So if you're a mechanical engineer, or if you're a biologist, of, you know, if you're a linguistics major, you learn a lot about that specific topic. Architecture is almost the opposite. It's probably the only generalist major, which means we learn a little bit about a wide variety of things. So we have to learn a little bit about math and physics and structures to be able to understand how a building, you know, can hold itself correctly. We have to learn about sociology, how people interact within a group, so that we can create a building that can work for the people. Because if you don't understand how people interact within a space, you can't create a functional space. Mm-hmm. We have to learn about, you know, biology, because you have to know what kind of trees grow in a specific place to be able to grow. And so we learn a little bit about a lot of different things so that we can have an educated conversation about all of those things, so that when it comes at the end of the day to build a building, we can kind of orchestrate all of those things together to make something successful. And, you know, there are a few things that are called, you know, practices. So being a doctor is called a practice. And it's called a practice because that's exactly what it is. It's practice. Doctors learn based off of what other doctors have done. You have to have a precedence. And if something worked before, then they know it's going to work after. And then they use that as a precedence for the next thing. Similarly, architecture is also a practice in the fact that you have to study what happened before to understand how to successfully create, you know, spaces after. And so that was one of the most intriguing parts of architecture for me. And that's the reason that I became an architect, because you can have a conversation with almost every single profession and still bring up architecture as a, you know, as a way to bring us all together. Because at the end of the day, statistically, people spend 90% of their time inside of a building.
That's so interesting when you think about it. I never really thought about that facet.
Exactly. If you have the ability to create how someone spends their time, that's very impactful. Mm-hmm. And
I'm curious.
That's the reason I became an architect.
Yeah, I'm curious too. Like, with that being said, is there just not, because as you describe it, it's so general. Are there even like those set trajectories of like maybe being a certain type of architect? Because it sounds like it's more of just based on your portfolio rather than necessarily you being able to say, well, I want to be a certain type of architect or a certain specialty of architect.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So architecture, when it comes to the actual profession, has niches, which means like specialties.
Yeah.
So you can spend your entire life designing specifically hospitals or specifically schools or civic buildings or residential.
What's typically the most common?
There isn't. I mean, like you need all of them.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going to break it down, there are obviously more houses than any other thing. Right? There's mm-hmm. there's more houses than there are hospitals or, you know, et cetera. But you kind of decide what you want to do after you graduate.
What are some of the projects that you've kind of taken on through your time as an architect?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So I originally graduated from Iowa State. In 2016, I went straight to Madison to a company called FLAD Architects. And FLAD Architects is like top 10 in the nation for creating hospitals, schools, and science and technology buildings. And so that means like, you know, laboratories for scientists and like, you know, surgical labs for surgeons and hospitals and things like that. So it was an incredibly intricate field. Mm-hmm. And we had specialists, like there were people that used to be doctors that came into the company just to teach people how does a surgeon operate? Like, what's the first thing a surgeon does when, you know, how does he clean himself? Like, what does he do after he cleans himself? Like, what tools does he need? So it's incredibly intricate. And so it was a very highly specialized kind of architecture. Unfortunately, most of the projects that I worked on when I was at FLAD are, like, we had to sign NDAs. And so I can't talk about them legally.
Okay. It's classic.
But there are a lot of, like, national laboratories that we did.
Can you break down maybe, because, you know, we have to respect that and, you know, we don't want you getting in trouble. Can you break down maybe what the process itself entails, regardless of, you know, without having to dive into the details of the project? So, like, let's say, you know, someone came up to you, said, hey, we have a proposal for something we want to build. Can you say what steps you're going to go through in regards to, like, getting that done from start to finish and, like, what that looks like from an architect's perspective?
Absolutely. So normally in an architectural process, there are three main steps that take, you know, to build an entire building.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes SDs, DDs, and CDs. And they stand for, respectively, schematic design, development design, and construction documentation.
Mm-hmm.
And after construction documentation, so I guess I should probably break those down further. So schematic design is like somebody comes to you with an idea, like, hey, I want to do this kind of project. These are the kind of people I want to house. This is what I want to go on. And so you kind of have a conversation about the intentions of a project, like what goes on into creating the project. You don't talk about, you know, I want this kind of material, I want this, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just intentions. And then you get into schematic design, and that's when you start putting, like, shapes to the spaces, and you start creating, like, you know, feeling to the space. And that's what schematic design is. And then the last step is construction documentation, and that's pretty much about telling the construction worker how to build what you created. And that's probably the most difficult part by far. If you ask any construction worker, they hate architects. There's like a huge, like, feud between architects and construction workers, because construction workers will be like, well, they're just trying to create the impossible, and architects have a vision. And there's a huge lack of communication between those two professions, which is something as a profession that we are slowly trying to build. And there is a conversation going on cross professionally about how to better create those kind of relationships. Generally, that's kind of what it takes to create a building. And your next question is probably going to be like, you know, how long does that take? And there's a huge variety depending on the project and the complexity and everything, how long that project takes. You know, there are projects that, you know, the client has the money and they know what they want and they're ready, and it could take like a year very quickly. But there are projects sometimes, let's say you're working for a nonprofit organization and they don't have the money, but they have the idea. And so you work with them and it could take 2 or 3 years because they're slowly, you know, building money, and then they can pay you as they go, but they just, like, don't have enough money to pay you. And so sometimes it takes a while.
Have you also done, like, I know we've discussed this, but you've done some even like outside consulting work as well, right? Can you talk about some of the work you've done consulting and how you kind of got into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, first and foremost, I will say I am not a licensed architect. Like, I do the work that an architect does, but legally, I cannot call myself an architect. And later on in this conversation, we'll talk about what it takes to become an actual architect. But legally, I can't call myself one yet. However, with the knowledge that I've gained through these past couple of years, I do have the ability to consult, just like you said. And so, my father is the leader of a religious organization back home in Iowa. And so we recently created a daycare. And so I was able to actually lay out the plans and render and create the daycare and get like an actual architect to sign off on it. And the building came up and see it to fruition. And that was probably the first building that I've ever seen that I designed come to fruition, like actually be built. And to be completely honest, that's probably the first time that all of the work that I've done as an architect has paid off. Like to see something that you had in your mind in real life, like happen, that was probably one of the most, proudest moments of my life as an architect. Because that's what we all dream of as architects, is to change the world. Architects become architects because they want to make an impact on the world. And the buildings that we build stay there forever, or at least until we die or someone demolishes them or something. But
I'm
like,
also curious too, with that being said, are you so we talked about, like the different you were mentioning, with architecture, it's not necessarily like it's not necessarily like career trajectory, it's just kind of whatever you necessarily envision for yourself, and you can kind of guide yourself into that niche. For yourself, what kind of whether what, I guess what do you kind of have mapped out for yourself, or where are you kind of looking to go into?
yeah, so personally, so like I told you before, I'm not an architect yet. And so I guess now is probably a good time to tell you like what it takes to actually become a licensed architect.
Yeah. But you practically just do everything they do. The only difference is you just can't put your signature on it, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So to become a licensed architect, the first thing that you have to do is to graduate from an accredited university. And so Iowa State University has an accredited architecture program. When I graduated from there, we were top 10 in the nation for accredited architecture programs, which is why it was a 5-year program and not a typical 4-year program. So when I graduated from architecture school, the first year was literally to get into the College of Architecture. And so you create a portfolio throughout the year with all of your work and ideas. And at the end of the year, you submit it and you make it or you don't. So the year that I submitted, we had 200 people apply and only 80 kids made
Wow.
it. And I was, they don't give you like your rank, but I was one of the 80, which I'm incredibly grateful for, because there are other students that will either try again next year or just find a different profession completely. So I made it and I went through the 4 years and I graduated with a degree in architecture and a minor in sustainability because I was interested in sustainability and architecture, which is a different conversation. And after that, after you graduate to become a licensed architect, you have to have two criteria. One of them is 3,500 hours in the field, like in the professional field.
Yeah.
And those 3,500 hours are broken up specifically. Like, for example, you have to have 100 hours on the construction field, like outside watching people build, etc. You have to have a certain number of hours creating construction documents. You have to have a certain number of hours doing schematic design, etc. I am very fortunate to be 3 years in and I have all of those hours completed. It usually takes about 4 to 5 years to finish all of those hours. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have a series of 6 tests. Those tests, you go to like a testing center and you study. There are specific study books for them. And each test ranges anywhere from 3 to 6 hours. And you take those tests. Most architecture firms, it costs about $250 to take the test. If you pass, most architecture firms will pay for those. If you don't pass, then you got to pay for it yourself. And so I've taken 2 tests. I passed the first one and I failed the second one. And so I'm studying right now to take the second one again. And after I pass all 6 of those tests, then I will legally become a licensed architect, which means I can sign my name off of things, which also means then I can start doing like side projects for a considerable amount of money. Aside from my job.
For sure. So would you ideally want to necessarily, after becoming a licensed architect, necessarily go maybe deeper into consulting for those projects and maybe potentially creating your own firm? Or would you prefer to necessarily, you know, do something else?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So as you know, I mean, like consultation is probably the most lucrative business in any profession, not just architecture, because as a consultant, you have the ability, you know, like the only reason somebody hires a consultant is because they have experience. Yeah. So if you hire a consultant, they are A, not liable for any of the advice that they give you. So as an architect, the reason that architects have to be licensed is, let's say you build a building and something happens and the building collapses. You have to blame it on somebody, right?
Yeah.
And so the liability falls on the architect if something like that happens. And that's why it's a licensed profession.
Yeah.
Similarly, that's why engineers are licensed, is because like if something happens to the machine or et cetera, you have to have liability.
Definitely. That's something that, you know, most people never to themselves would like really think about. Like, I guess, is there maybe insurance for that? Or like, is there's nothing necessarily that covers
there, there is a lot of insurance for that. And to start an architectural company, there are different kinds of insurances. Like one of the tests to become an architect is to understand the business side of architecture. And they talk about insurance and they talk about liability and they talk about contracts. Like that's a huge part of architecture, because at the end of the day, somebody has to pay for something when something goes wrong.
Definitely. They don't play games. You got to pay up.
Not at all. No, there are architecture lawyers, like people that have become architects that then become lawyers. And those people are the ones that will dictate, like, let's say something goes wrong in the building. Somebody has to investigate, like, okay, what went wrong? And then after they figure out what went wrong, they have to visit the contract and figure out, okay,
who's responsible?
Per this contract, who was at fault, you know? Oh. So that's an entire other, you know, thing. But personally, I want to own my own business. Whether it's in architecture or not, because of, you know, the story that I told you before, my goal is to try to help my people. Like I want to be able to be in a position where I can like give my friends and my community jobs, you know?
Yeah.
So if that means I do it in architecture, then that's the case. If not, then I don't. But either way, once I acquire my licensing, I will continue to design buildings for people. And personally, I like designing houses, like residential areas.
Do you see yourself maybe getting into real estate with it? I think that'd be a crazy combo.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's actually, you know, it takes a while, but it's not that difficult to get your real estate license. And once you do, like in the building, like sphere. So like in buildings in general, there are like three main players, right? There's like the developer who actually pays for it and owns it, right? And there's the construction company that builds it, and there's the architecture that designs it. Of all of those, like the developer by far makes the most money. Like that's the real estate
position to be both a developer and an architect, and like for a developer, don't
they? That's the money man. Yeah. And there are development companies that have in-house architects, which means the developer will tell the architect to build the building and they build it for them, and the developer pays it and they already own it. Which means that the amount of profit that those people make like is ridiculous. And that's kind of the position that I want to put myself in, but that's a long road ahead.
No, for sure. And I'm confident you're going to get there. And it's just a matter of due time at this point, man. I'm curious too, you know, you talked also about how it's very rare to see people that like us in architecture. I'm curious, has there been an effort in the industry to at least try to diversify the types of folks that are going into architecture? And if so, what have those efforts kind of looked like?
Yeah, that's a very good question as well. So I actually, a year and a half ago, I was a co-founder to NOMA, which is the National Organization of Minority Architects, mm-hmm. which is a, you know, international, it's an international entity, just like NSBE. I'm sure a lot of people know what NSBE is. It's pretty much NSBE for architects. Yeah. And so for a very long time, Wisconsin did not have enough Black architects to be able to create such a chapter within the state. And once I got here and, you know, a bunch of other people got here and we were able to come together, and we actually created the first Wisconsin chapter of NOMA.
That's amazing, man.
Well, I was a co-founder of NOMA, and I'm currently the treasurer of Wisco NOMA, which is our official name. If you'd like to visit the website, it's called wisconoma.com. And we've been doing, despite COVID-19 and stuff, we've been doing a lot of outreach. And so organizations like that kind of create, what's the word I'm looking for? They create a platform for people like us to be able to explore architecture. Because like me, very many minorities see an architect, like a Black or minority architect. And that's the only way for you to know that that's even a thing, you know, because just like you said at the beginning of this podcast, there are a lot of, you know, things that young Black kids try to aspire to. And it's mostly artists and, you know,
athletics.
Athletics, because that's who they see. And so as Wisco NOMA, we try to expose ourselves to as many children and youth as possible.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of programs where we do, you know, youth building to show them like, hey, this is architecture, this is what we do. And so we've worked with, you know, Vericourt Village, which is a local after school program here. Wisconsin, specifically Madison, is also home to Michael Ford. And Michael Ford has dubbed himself the hip hop architect. And I encourage everybody that's interested in architecture to look him up, because he's a very big deal now, and he's making a lot of moves for our people to move architecture into a field that youth, especially our youth, are engaged in. And personally, like I told you before, because like we're part of, you know, we're part of the lowest ranking profession for Black and minorities, the youth is our future. If we don't expose them to it now, like that profession will die for our people. And it's an incredibly impactful profession. And so we have to have people like us to make those moves, because like, for example, when you live in a space and, you know, create spaces and they're not created specifically for you, like you're already at a disadvantage. And as you know, like Black and minorities in America are already at a disadvantage. So if architecture has the ability to create a space that can help us, like we all have to make an intentional move to help that cause.
Definitely, that's powerful, man. That's some amazing work. And you use the term hip hop architect. What was that term mean? Can you go a little bit deeper into that?
Yeah. So the reason that I'm smiling is that, like, so first of all, it's kind of like an ambiguous term, and you really have to like research it to find out what it is. Mm-hmm. My roommate, Kouyaté Touré, is also an architect, and he did his master's on hip hop architecture, and pretty much it's, and I may be just like killing it, so like, you know, please take what I'm about to say with a grain of salt, but it's about integrating the Black culture into architecture. Mm-hmm. And so my roommate was part of a workshop last year with Michael Ford, that they brought a bunch of different rappers together and like famous people. Lupe Fiasco was there. He met Lupe, and they created art and music, and then they transformed that music into architecture in a number of different ways. And I very much, you know, advise anyone that's interested in that to just look it up, because it's not really something that can be explained. Like, you just have to see it and hear it.
That's awesome,
though. So look up Michael Ford, look up hip hop architecture, and you'll understand a little bit what it's about. But it's really about bringing the Black culture into an era of architecture.
That's amazing. Because
you mentioned, technically, white people have been doing this forever. And so all of the architecture that you see now is like based off of like the way they live, the way
it's accommodated,
you know, they set up their cities and et cetera, everything. So for us to be able to kind of create our own communities and our own, you know, what's the word, like stance is to do that. And architecture is one of those ways.
For sure. And you know, another thing too, is what you were saying is, with having the, you know, that next generation of children be the ones that come in and make that impact and, you know, help push those numbers. With you currently being in architecture, I guess what's kind of, can you go a little, talk a little bit about how you've been able to navigate, you know, being in that predominantly white field, and what advice you would have for maybe someone that's like now just coming out of school or maybe going into an industry that might be similar to architecture where it's predominantly white, which is almost every industry?
Absolutely. So that's an interesting question. So I'll say this, first of all, like connections mean a lot. And in architecture specifically, like I was on the hiring committee when I was at FLAD. And so I was able to have like a say in the people that came in. And I won't say that I had a bias to minority or black people that came in, but if there were people that were, you know, worthy of acceptance, I would always lean towards them. And similarly, people want people that are like them to work with them.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just like human nature. And because of that, because architecture is a predominantly, you know, white profession, it's difficult. It's not as difficult to get in it because architecture is a talent-based profession. So like you can have like not good grades, but have a really good portfolio.
Yeah.
And get into architecture because of the work that you do, which was, to be honest, my case. Like I didn't do like the best in college, but because of the level of my work, I was able to get in because people could see what I did. So anybody can get in because it's talent-based. But once you're in, the problem for Black and minority people is to get into that management position.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult thing to do. And it's honestly a conversation that we can't have alone. It's a conversation that we have to have with the higher ups, with people at different profession, you know, levels. And
have to be in that.
Yeah, and we have done that. So the National Organization of Minority Architects, NOMA, Wisco NOMA in specific, has been working with AIA, which is the architect with the American Institute of Architects. The American Institute of Architects has a convention every year, and we have worked with them for a specific conversation. And so we have a panel of architects, and I don't know why it happened now. Maybe it's because of all of the unrest that's been going on or whatever, but AIA has started to take interest in the Black opinion.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say it's because it's trendy or because like that's what's happening now and that's what companies want to do to stay kind of like, you know, woke.
Yeah, or it's performative in a sense.
Yeah, and even if that is the case, like, we should definitely take the opportunity to take that stand. And so I've been working with a panel to create a series that is about, like, you know, Black architects and, like, what the adversities are of Black architects and how, you know, it's been holding people down and what America in general, like, lacks from having Black people in management positions as, you know, architectural professions. And so there are steps that are being made, but I think the youth is probably our biggest, that's the easiest way for us to progress. Yeah, I hope that answered the question. I don't know if I
was kind of, no, it definitely, it hit on some of the issues, you know, within the industry itself. But in regards to, you know, till that point, you know, it does come like for yourself, what are you doing to go about navigating it within the current environment? And what advice do you have for folks in other industries on how to navigate it, whether it is architecture and like engineering? It's definitely not 1%, but you know, we're maybe right behind in a sense.
I see what you're saying. Personally, I think the easiest way to do it is like whenever, and this is beyond architecture, just in the professional realm in general, is like if you want to make an impact, find a specific thing that is lacking within the profession or within the company that you're in and specialize in it. Because the easiest way to make yourself an asset is to become indispensable.
Yeah.
And you are indispensable once you know how to do something that nobody else in the company knows how to do. So if you find something that's lacking, learn it. Even if it's not something that you're interested in per se, you know, but like you notice that, you know, there's something lacking in this field or in this specific process, even if there's a certain process that you do something in people are lacking in it, like learn that and become indispensable. And once you become indispensable, that's when you have a say in what happens in where you work. And at the end of the day, the only thing that makes you strong is like having a word.
Okay.
And personally, like I used to work at a large firm and I moved to a small firm for multiple reasons, because when you're at a large firm, you have a lot of resources. And so you can focus on doing your job and you have a lot of resources to base yourself. You know, if you have a question, you can ask this person. If, you know, like if I have a computer question, I can ask the IT person. If I have a printing question, I can ask the printing person. Like in architecture, if I have something with codes or specs, I can ask them. And that helps you do your job better. But once you move to a small firm, you have to do all of those things yourself, right? And that's a good and a bad thing. And I would advise every person that gets into architecture or any profession is to go into a large firm first, because you will always have resources. But at some point, those resources will hinder you, because you don't have to learn those things because you always have someone to answer that question. And yeah. That's when you move to a small firm, because then you are forced to learn those things yourself, because there's no one there to help you.
Definitely. That's some great advice. I'm also kind of curious now, if someone's thinking like, hey, is architecture for me, what skills or characteristics do you know, firms look for in an architect, and what advice do you have on how to develop those skills or characteristics as a college student, prior to getting, you know, to that graduation date? Like what can you do to work on your portfolio and things of that nature?
Yeah. That's a great question. So originally I was like a math and science person. I like having an answer. Like when you have a big question, you have to answer the question, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, you have an answer and that's the correct answer. And that made me feel satisfied. Like,
yeah.
That's why I love math and science. Getting into architecture, you cannot be that kind of person, or else you will be miserable. Because in architecture, there is no right answer, ever. And that's one of the reasons why I liked getting into it, is because I kind of challenged myself. Like I had the idea of like structures and math and science of architecture, how to create a building so that it doesn't fall down. But architecture, the word itself is like art and structures, and you put it together, that's architecture. And yeah. So that whole other part, the art part of it, I did not have. When I came into college, I could barely draw stick people. Like, I could not draw whatsoever. And a lot of people think that architects are like incredibly creative and gifted. And to be honest, like I am now, but it is learned, you know. There are people that are naturals at those things, but you can definitely learn it. And I didn't learn it when I was in college. I'll be completely honest right now. When I was in college, I cheated my way through my drawing classes. Like, I would take pictures. I would take pictures of, like, what we're supposed to draw and then just trace it. Because I didn't have time for it. And I failed myself. Like, that's one of my regrets. Because going into the field, you still need those... you still need those traits and those skills. And I have it now, but it took me a lot longer to learn it because I cheated myself earlier. But I would take, like, in architecture school, they don't teach you specific things. Mm-hmm. Architecture isn't about, like, learning facts. It's about learning a mindset. Like, in architects, like, architects learn how to think. That's what they teach you in architecture school.
Necessarily, like, being a critical thinker. You mentioned working with ambiguity and then, you know, developing the artistic ability as well as, like, having a decent technical breadth as well.
Yep.
And then
I would also add, like, just, like, being detail-oriented to that. Like, just, like, thinking about everything. Like, you think about every single aspect, like, from small to big. When you think about how somebody sits down, when they sit down, like, what do they see, you know? Like, and that's how you design what's in front of you, like, because you see what they see.
For sure. And now with those, like, five things, what experiences can someone, like, look into, or maybe would you advise them to pursue while they're in school, or maybe before they even get into school, to better position themselves for a career in architecture, whether, like, maybe are there internships or things of that nature? How would you advise them to go about, you know, pursuing those experiences?
First and foremost, I would advise someone that's interested in architecture to be genuinely interested.
Yeah.
And I mean that in all aspects of everything in their life. Like, when they're having a conversation with somebody, like, be engaged with them and understand really what they're thinking. If you're sitting down and you're just people watching, be genuinely engaged in, like, what people are doing and how they're acting. If, you know, like whatever you do, there's something to be learned from it if you're genuinely engaged. Like, if you're curious. Like, so I think curiosity is, like, probably the biggest thing. So I'll give you an example. So you went to Iowa State as well. At Iowa State, in the Memorial Union, in the entrance of the Memorial Union, we have the Zodiac.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that Zodiac, when people walk in, like, what do?
Everyone walks around it because of...
Exactly. I didn't even have to say it. Everybody walks around it. And
I don't. I stomp over it.
Yeah, and good for you. You're
I never did that.
Yeah, so it's funny. So the reason that people walk around it, so the Zodiac was made out of copper. Like, those Zodiac signs, they stick out of the ground just a little bit. Like, and so the reason that they stick out of the ground is that when the architect built it, he thought that, like, when people started stepping on it, it would, you know, over time, the copper would, you know, kind of, like, not melt away, but, like, you know, it scrapes away. And so that over time it would be flat. But because he built it with, like, a little bit of, like, a lisp, people were afraid to walk on it because it had a little bump to it. Yeah. And then over time, people, you know, we made up
people would say it's, like, bad luck to step on it.
It's bad luck, yeah. If you step on the Zodiac, then you're going to fail your next test type thing. And right now, if you go to the Memorial Union, it still has a bump to it because people are afraid to walk around it.
I never fully understood that. Maybe it's just kind of like the way I'm wired in a sense, but it's literally like 98% of the people I see there will never actually step over it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and the crazy part is like, they'll come in from, you know, another city. They're not even from Ames, first year in Iowa State. And it's just, sometimes people don't even ask the question. Like, the first time I saw
it, they just do what other people are doing. So they just walk around it just like they see everyone do.
And that never made sense to me. Why do people not question, you know, why people like, you know, especially something that minute. And then and like sometimes I get looks all the time, like you stepped on this. And I'm just like, look, I'm not even going to entertain this conversation. You know, you yourself don't even know why you're, you know, walking around it. So
exactly.
I'm going to continue.
So for one of my final projects when I was in college, we had to install like an installation on campus. And so we put in an installation inside of that corridor, like mm-hmm. that vestibule, where we put these walls up between the two doors that forced people to walk through them, like to walk through the Zodiac. And we took a video of it, and you could see how uneasy people were to walk through the Zodiac, but they can't not, because like we put up those walls, and so they have nowhere else to go. So now all these people are kind of like walking over it. And you know, you can kind of like assess that. And as an architect, like, that's our goal. Like, you have the ability to affect the way people interact in a space. And that experiment that we did was case in point, like making people interact in a space where in that scenario, they were uncomfortable with it. But like, our goal obviously is to make people feel comfortable, you know, and architects design things like that all over. Like, for example, like in McDonald's, the seats in all fast food restaurants, but McDonald's was the first one of them because they hired an architect to deduce a space where someone could sit long enough where they're comfortable enough to eat, but not comfortable enough to stay, because they want people to come in and out.
And that was kind of like the start. Would you say that was kind of like the start of the fast food chains, in a sense, or like the concept of fast food, just in and out?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, yeah, in terms of architecture and seating, absolutely. And that's the power of architecture. And that's why I got into it to begin with.
And just to kind of switch gears here, kind of curious to also ask you, you know, where you mentioned some of the goals you're kind of working towards and what you want to do moving forward, but what's kind of like success mean to you?
Yeah. I mean, this is probably an answer that has nothing to do with architecture, but for me, success is to be in a position where I can be comfortable with the people and community, that I grew up with. I want to be in a position to help everybody that I grew up with. And so to me, success is to own some type of business where we all succeed together.
Yeah. What was that?
Yeah.
And then I'm also kind of curious to ask you, like, have you had mentors that kind of guided you throughout your journey? And if so, what has been the impact of mentorship in kind of your development?
Yeah. I think mentorship is crucial. I think it is the most underestimated. It is the most underestimated impact of someone's life that there is. If you don't have a mentor, I guess I can speak to it in architecture, and then I can speak to it broadly. But in architecturally, there has to be somebody that knows your progress. And like, even within, you know, I told you it takes like 3,600 hours and then, or 3,500 hours, and then those series of six tests, like somebody has to sign off on those hours. And the person that does that is your mentor. And the reason that they have somebody sign off on that is because they want to know that there's somebody that's veteran that understands, that was there when you learned that. And architecture is not one of those things that you can just like learn by yourself, like by attending a lecture or watching a class. Like, you got to be out there. Like, I can make a drawing, like, oh, build it like this, but I won't really know if someone built it like that unless I'm like out there looking at him build it. Like, there's a huge difference between what happens on paper and what happens in real life. And like your mentor makes sure that happens.
What's the best piece of advice you've gotten from a mentor?
The best piece of advice I've gotten from a mentor, he said the tool makes the architect. And I think that applies in multiple fields, which means like whatever tool that you have, if you're using a pencil and a ruler to explain something, is different than if you're using like a computer program to explain something, right? Like it would take me an hour to draw something on the with a piece of paper and a ruler, but maybe 20 minutes to draw it on the computer. And like the tool that you use to explain something, like he told me, like architecture is like storytelling. And that really is what architecture is. Like for a client, architecture is storytelling, because you're explaining to them like how they envision the building to be. And so you show them pretty pictures and like, you know, what the end product is, so they can be like, wow, that looks awesome. But to a construction worker, those pretty pictures won't help anything. It's storytelling, because you're telling them a story of how to build it. And that's what a construction document is. And so the tool that you use to explain that affects how they understand the story. And I think that also applies in real life, that the tool that you use to explain something to somebody like affects how they understand it.
Definitely. It comes back to that communication sense. Everyone has that different style.
Yep. So that's probably the biggest, that's probably the best advice that I've gotten from a mentor.
Definitely. That's great advice. And then one last question before kind of wrapping up. I'm kind of curious to ask you, like, what you know now, what advice would you have for your younger self?
Go into a different profession.
What profession would you have wanted into?
Architecture is difficult. I love it. I love it so much. Like, I enjoy producing something with my hands and seeing an end result. But it's difficult. I work 50, 60, 70 hours. I make an impact, but it's difficult. It's not for the person that wants to live an easy life. Like, if you're about the work and you really are about impact, like, architecture is for you. If you're not, like, don't try. And there are a lot of times where I, like, you know, I'll be sitting at like 2, 3 a.m. I mean, you know me, like, we were in college together, so, like, you know, the long nights that I had.
Those late nights of design.
Yeah, it's you know.
Yeah, I'll put in this.
It's not for the faint of heart.
News, like, to be honest.
If you're trying to make money and just, like, go on with your life, like, by all means, go into, you know, engineering or one of the – not that engineering is easy. It is not easy. That's not what I'm saying.
Easier than architecture, time commitment wise, I'd say.
Yeah, time commitment wise. I won't say, like, I would say that engineering is more difficult than architecture, but architecture is more time consuming.
Definitely, there's a lot more thought that goes into it as an engineer. It's black and white. It's not as
because architecture is like a cyclical process. Like, engineering is like you start here and then the answer is here.
Yeah, for sure.
Architecture is like you start here and then you go around and then keep going around and then until time is up, you know.
And then I'm curious, if someone kind of wants to reach out to you and ask for, you know, advice or just want to connect with you, what would be the best way to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So I will put my I will give you my phone number, and anybody that asks for my phone number, I will answer any call if they're interested in architecture. Otherwise, I will refer everyone to my email, which is shahataarch at gmail.com, which is SHEHATA at gmail.com. And anybody can ask me anything. I live for mentorship because I had people my entire life helping me. So I definitely believe in paying that back. So I will answer any question that anybody has. But if you want to get in direct contact with me, then hit up Ahmed and he can give you my number. And then we can either text or talk on the phone.
That's awesome. Thank you, man. Thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. And thanks.
Absolutely.
I'm going to hop on the podcast. It means a lot.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You're doing great stuff, man. This is wonderful.
Really appreciate it. And then
I'm glad I could be a part of it.
Yeah, for sure. We're going to have you here again sometime soon, hopefully. And then everybody, thank you all for tuning in. And tune into the next one. It's going to be Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time.